It's probably a little cooler out here than the water.
All right. Hi, welcome. Could people have a seat? We'll get started here.
Did you tell him that or shall I? Go ahead and take your seat.
I don't think, yeah, because it's, that's like,
Hi, welcome. Today is Thursday, August 1st, 2024. It's 5:30 p.m. This is the regular meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board. We'll go ahead and get started. It's a call to order and do a quick roll call. Member Dowdy?
Here.
Member French?
Here.
Member Hansen?
Here.
Member Myers, present. Member Vail?
Here.
Member Green?
Here.
Member Witowski?
Here.
Full house, Lori. All in attendance. Call to order. We'll, next up is we'll do a moment of silence for all the strange things that are going on in the world. All right, thank you. Member Green, if you'd lead us off in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Next up on the agenda, we'll start with the committee member announcements. We do that first with the presentation. Announcements. All right, I'll start over here on my left. Abby.
Good evening. Not much is happening on the waterfront. The tide goes in, tide goes out. The fog comes in, the fog goes out. Eelgrass is starting to show up in pretty good bunches now. And fishing in the bay is kind of slow. That's my take.
All right, thank you. Member French, any announcements?
Not really too much, no. Fishing is slow. That's an understatement.
All right, thank you. Member Hansen?
I'm just going to mention that whale watching is doing great. I've had a lot of guests say that they have seen more whales than they've ever seen on a trip. So that's just nice to know that they're out there and people can enjoy them.
All right, thank you. I'll jump all the way to the end. Member Witowski, any announcements you'd like to make?
Sure. I wanted to shout out the Morro Bay Rotary Ducky Derby, which the date was published will be October 14th, 2020, or this year. And so it's always a fun event with kids, or sorry, I was looking at 2023, October 5th, Saturday. And I don't know, Chris, if the Maritime Museum is doing a family fun day. They have in the past done that, I think, on the same day as the Ducky Derby. But it's usually a fun time to be with kids in Morro Bay.
Thank you. Member Green?
I have a few here. The first day of the academic term at Cuesta is Monday, August 12th. Cal Poly returns the week of September 16th, so about a month after Cuesta. So there'll be influx of parents for a couple weeks, weekends in a row, depending on when kids are getting dropped off. The Morro Bay Planning Commission, for anyone who's interested, you can come to the Vets Hall any first or third Tuesday of the month to see what they have going on. You can always submit agenda correspondence to any city body up until around 9 a.m. The day of a meeting if you want your comments to be published as part of the agenda packet. This is probably going to appear on another report at some point, but Harbor Director's last day was July 19th here at our Harbor Department. And then we have also Council's talked about this multiple times, but the and it's been in the news, but Morro Bay and Ironman, or Ironman, dropped out of their third year of their three-year contract. It looks like 2025 will not have an Ironman race. Those are my announcements. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Member Vail?
It's all quiet on the waterfront. It seems the Morro Bay Museum is very busy. And, yes, Family Fun Day is coming up. And the city has joined in to, they're sort of dovetailing some other events. our Family Fun Day, which is completely great for kids. They get to wander around and play without being on kind of a leash like they would have to be down at on the Embarcadero itself. Food, fun, games, all kinds of stuff goes on. But apparently the city of Morro Bay is going to have an event Friday night, for instance, and other things going on Sunday and Saturday that sort of will turn the whole thing into a town event rather than just the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. And other than that, I didn't really know there was a meeting tonight until yesterday, so I got nothing.
All right, thank you. I have no announcements at this time. Next, we'll move on to, we're super pleased to have, I'm going to get the name wrong, Melody Grubbs present about the eelgrass. If you want to come up, I think we have your thumb drive ready to go. You're with the, what is it?
National Estuary Program.
Okay, thank you. Pat? We'll see how good of a driver Becca is. All right, and then the full screen.
How many?
Yay!
Hey,
okay.
Awesome, thank you, Becca. good evening, council members. My name is Melody Grubbs. I'm the executive director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. We're also known as the Estuary Program here locally. So just a couple slides about who we, I know a lot of you know us very well, but we are a non-regulatory 501c3 nonprofit based here in Morro Bay. We our office is right across the Shell Shop on the Embarcadero, and we have a free nature center there as well that's open during the gallery hours. As part of being a National Estuary Program, each year we receive a non-competitive grant from the Environmental Protection Agency, so we consider them a key partner in implementing our local-based program. We were established in 1995. It became an estuary of state significance in 1994, and that was largely due to a very local grassroots effort to get this program established. So we are one of 28 National Estuary Programs in the U.S., and so what we do a whole bunch of stuff, but we have these kind of three program areas. We do environmental education and outreach. We have a pretty comprehensive monitoring team that goes out and collects environmental monitoring data. And then we do habitat restoration and enhancement. And we don't work just in the estuary. We work in the watersheds that feed Morro Bay. So we have a pretty large study area that we work in. And so here you can see a picture of the Morro Bay watershed being called a National Estuary Program. A lot of people associate us with just working in the estuary, but we also do a lot of other work in our creek habitats and waters that feed into the estuary. So we work all the way up past Highway 1, and we partner with folks like Camp Slow and Cuesta. And we do a lot of riparian restoration and floodplain restoration up in those areas. And so again, we have these three program areas: monitoring and research, restoration and conservation, and education and outreach. The estuary program has been extremely busy with the increase in supplemental funding through the bipartisan infrastructure law. So we have several ongoing projects, and particularly proud of our education efforts over the last couple of years. We've been able to host a series of six teacher training programs that are using the estuary and the habitats around the estuary as kind of a living laboratory for teachers to take that curriculum back into their schools. So it's been a really neat way to get a lot of folks knowing about Morro Bay and learning about Morro Bay. And so to the fun stuff, I wanted to give the board a quick update on eelgrass. And so we, just as a reminder, we do this bay-wide eelgrass extent mapping effort sometimes every year, sometimes every couple years. It depends on the conditions and it depends on funding. These are pretty costly surveys. But we are just wrapping up our 2023 eelgrass report, which should be coming out in the next month or so. It's in the final stages. So this is kind of a little snip into what that report is going to have. And so this is the eelgrass condition or extent from last year, the data that we collected last year. It takes a lot of time to process with our academic partners. But here I wanted to just give you a quick rundown. And you can see just from the vivid green color that in the last decade, Morro Bay has experienced a dramatic decline and then a recovery of eelgrass. And that's really the main takeaway here is we went from the fall of 2017 to less than 13 acres. And our results from 2023 show that we have nearly 750 acres of eelgrass. It looks like almost the entire back bay and everything aside from the channels. One thing to note is that methods for mapping have changed over the years, and this is also influenced by mapping kind of guidance that comes from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and how eelgrass beds are protected in the state. And so I just wanted to point that out because while this looks like a lot of eelgrass, 750 acres, it doesn't account for different densities. So if you have a patch of eelgrass that's like a few shoots, like that's still gonna get mapped with a buffer around it as an eelgrass bed. So just a disclaimer looking at this map. And also some of the things we've seen are that we've done with this map are concurrent bathymetry of the bay. So at extreme low tide, we do LIDAR. We do flights over to measure the elevation of the bay because eelgrass is very sensitive to different elevations and where it wants to grow. And so we have found some shifts in elevation, which could be one of the reasons why eelgrass is rebounding. And so just a couple photos just to see the different changes over the years. This goes back from 2017 to the bottom right, 2019 to the left, and then the most current is 2023, which is on the top left. And you can see these are photo points that are established in some of our quadrat and transect monitoring. You can visually see like no eelgrass and then all of a sudden this huge rebound of eelgrass over the years. Another site I wanted to point out is Pasadena Point. This is pretty vivid. You can also see the difference in densities over the years in eelgrass. But bottom line is you can see from 2017-18, we had barely any eelgrass in these areas and now it's recovered. And so just talking about trends because it has had this up and down over the years. You know, restoration efforts and significant natural establishment, meaning natural recruitment of eelgrass, we can't take credit for all of the eelgrass that's been restored, have brought a major resurgence of eelgrass habitat within the 500 acres mapped in 2021 and then 750 acres in 2023. We do expect to see a reduction in acreage over the years, and this is mainly due because the bay is basically what we think at carrying capacity. Like this is as much eelgrass as it can take. So we expect to see a decline. Bathymetry surveys, again, were also conducted showing that over 70% of the estuary falls between this depth of plus 0.5 feet and negative 0.5 feet, which is like the optimum growth range for eelgrass. And so that's why it's important to do some of these supplementary data sets as well so we can understand what's really going on in the bay. And then continued monitoring is going to be essential for tracking eelgrass fluctuations and if needed, enacting any restorative methods. We are not doing restoration at this point. We stopped a couple years ago when we started seeing eelgrass come back, and we focused more on monitoring and understanding what's really going on in the bay. And so some of the monitoring efforts or recent monitoring efforts include a partnership with Cal Poly and a group called the Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System, also known as CENCOOS. It's a mouthful. We have a lot of acronyms in our field. And these are two pretty high-tech water quality, real-time water quality sensor packages that are installed in the front of the bay and in towards the middle back bay. But this is a really cool project. It's a partnership with a local university and a statewide West Coast data censoring network. And I wanted to call that out because this is a recent project that we've supported and we think it's really important, but it's also a really cool stream for like public to access real-time water quality data. And so the link is here, but you can basically Google CENCOOS Morro Bay and you'll find these sensors and you can make all kinds of cool charts or see the water temperature or water level. We are also in the process of a bay-wide fisheries survey, and so with the recovery of eelgrass in all these different parts of the bay, we have some sparse fisheries data sets within the bay that were conducted by Cal Poly and some other universities nearly a decade ago, and so This is kind of a repeat survey to see what's going on with the recovery of eelgrass and how the fish are using these habitats. So we hope that this data or report will be available, not quite sure yet, maybe next year, but most definitely with the next State of the Bay, which we publish every 3 years. And in conclusion, you know, eelgrass plays a really vital role in the health of the Morro Bay ecosystem. Lots of wildlife use it, lots of fisheries use it. Acreage has fluctuated in the past, and in this last decade, we've seen the most decline in recovery, meaning it's been very dramatic, up and down. In 2023, we have eelgrass climbing to record highs, so this is the most eelgrass that we've ever mapped since we've been mapping eelgrass. It's more than double the average present pre-decline records. And recovery is complicated, but it's likely the result of a combination of factors, including shifts in elevation, water quality, natural recruitment of eelgrass, and restoration efforts. And broader changes in climate will most definitely continue to modify conditions in the bay. So those are also parameters that we're monitoring. And we will continue monitoring eelgrass health in acreage and pursue monitoring and research projects that help us better understand the bay. Oftentimes, these are projects in collaboration with our local university or even going down to Santa Barbara, and we're even doing stuff with Cuesta College. And that's it. Any questions?
Yeah, I'm sure we have a few. Yeah. I know, does anybody have questions? Charisse, I know you mentioned you might have a few. Go ahead, Member Dowdy.
Yes. My question is, how does the Bay Foundation tie in with the National History Program? And the other question is there any commercial value in eelgrass?
Well, those are both good questions. So the Morro Bay National Estuary Program is the Bay Foundation, so we are DBA, and so it's the one and the same entity. The National Estuary Program name comes from the designation of this kind of network of National Estuary Programs through the EPA. And then your second question, I personally, that's not my area of specialty, but we most definitely could look that up and see what ongoing things are going with eelgrass. In terms of, like, I haven't heard of eelgrass being used in, like, aquaculture kind of market, per se, but there have been some folks that I think making, like, textiles or, like, you know, weaving things from eelgrass as well. But in terms of, like, established kind of industry, I'm not aware, in California at least, of that.
I think the brant hunters are really happy about it too, though, because I think brant eats eelgrass from what I recall too, so maybe those are some folks that are happy. I had a question for you on, like, what do you think the biggest dog not barking is kind of with the bay? And what I mean with that is, like, we've had presentations on, like, sea otters and disruption to sea otters and a lot of focus on eelgrass. I was curious on your perspective of, like, is there a concern with the bay that you're aware of that you don't think is getting enough attention right now?
That's a good question. You know, we have lots of different facets of our program that we try to keep an eye out for, and, you know, things involving even some of the energy, you know, discussions. We're kind of on the sidelines reading those EIR reports and kind of and looking over. I think one of our big efforts that we're currently undertaking is a project with the U.S. Geological Survey to better understand the impacts of sea level rise to the bay, and particularly the buffering habitats around the bay and what will happen kind of in that back marsh area. When you're driving down South Bay Boulevard and you see the tide, you know, super high or super low, it kind of looks very like a similar landscape. But when you kind of dive down and looking, like, at those exposed habitats, there's actually a lot of different type of habitats that certain species rely on. So we have, like, mud flats versus more marsh areas that maybe aren't exposed to those tides, and then even fringe habitats on the sidelines, and they're quite distinguishable by the type of plant species that are growing there. Sometimes they're sensitive and rare species, and even the wildlife and insects that use those habitats. And so those are kind of the things that we're looking at, is more of the short and long-term planning for either sea level rise or, you know, potential areas that are vulnerable to flooding, which we know has been an issue here in the last couple of years particularly. So we've been involved in a lot of projects like that in partnership with organizations like the Resource Conservation District that's looking into the reevaluation and flooding issues going on at Chorro Flats, and then also with the SLO Council of Governments, who's conducting kind of a transportation silver rise vulnerability analysis of South Bay Boulevard and the Marina Road right there.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Melody. A lot of the things that that you guys work on is restoration and rehabilitation. And I look at the bay as the healthiest that I've ever seen it in the 25 years that I've been here. My future concerns are actually not in the restoration, but actually the maintenance of those items, because there's a point where you have too many, and it could be otters, too many otters, could be too much eelgrass, it could be another ton of different, like, little microscopic organisms. But have you ever done research or did any kind of work to maintain or suggest maintenance?
Well, most definitely. I think a lot of our programs are not just brand new opportunistic restoration projects. We're notoriously restoration projects, at least 20 years ago, were like, you go in there, you do restoration, and then you maybe maintain it for a year, and then you leave, and then it's back to it, you know, that's invasive weed or some other kind of condition years later. And so maintenance is a really important component of our program. And definitely thinking about that from a capacity standpoint is important. Additionally, like when you're talking about, you know, is there too many sea otters, or is there too much eelgrass, or is there not enough eelgrass? The bay is so dynamic, and one of the challenges with managing such a beautiful natural landscape is that we're working with a changing baseline. And so it's so dynamic, you know, that we had, depending on the weather that year or depending on long-term climate trends, or we have folks looking into things like ocean acidification, or even working really closely with like the oyster farmers and making sure that we have balanced uses in the bay. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but yes, that's something, you know, we're thinking of on a day-to-day basis. And also trying to develop planning techniques where we're not just going out and doing all the restoration we can, but really trying to approach these projects comprehensively, but also like very strategically and prioritizing different projects. You know, while we do have this non-competitive grant through the EPA, it is limited funding. And I will say our staff, which is full-time, currently 10, but we at any time can have 10 to 20 staff on our team. We do a lot with, like, the little staff that we have here. That's, I think, something the National Estuary Programs pride themselves on. And so we still have capacity, you know, issues like any other organization in manpower, woman power, and also funding.
I was going for a situation where maybe there would be a point where you would either advocate for or even go out and do some revitalizing for, like, say, eelgrass. It will shade itself out. You know, it will create flotsam over an area, and then it can't grow. And so as far as maintenance goes, has there ever been anything that the NEP has done in order to kind of remove some excess?
Not eelgrass in particular, and that's primarily because there's a lot of regulations regarding eelgrass and the kind of thinning or removal of eelgrass that go beyond kind of our capacity as a National Estuary Program. These are issues and things that, like, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and state parks would need to be involved in, if you're talking about eelgrass specifically, only because it's a protected species. When we do projects in the creek areas, you know, like when we seed with native vegetation or plant trees, you know, thinning like that is a common practice, even with native species, but these are not, again, protected species that we're dealing with. And so we have not partaked in any of those activities. But we are in good discussions with kind of day-to-day operations with Harbor Patrol and the issues, you know, that they're facing, particularly with, like, eelgrass coming out with the tide, or the rack, as we call it, that's no longer connected to the ground, kind of clogging up different areas of boating activity or docks and piers. So that is something that we do communicate, you know, with. But in terms of maintenance, like that's a little bit beyond our realm of regulatory.
Any other questions? All right, with that, with Melanie, we appreciate your time.
Are you seeing an?
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no, go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Are you seeing an increase in the wild pig population out there?
Oh, that's a good question. I personally have seen an increase with my own two eyes driving to work often. I'll see them during low tide. We're not actively monitoring the pigs, but we are in discussions with both state parks and CDFW, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and even the USDA, who's a partner with CDFW on potential pig management actions. You know, they're pretty cute running around. They make a lot of babies, but they can be destructive to different marsh habitats and even dune habitats if they get out in the sand spit. So historically, there has been management efforts kind of. They're just as needed depending on the pig population and if they hang out around the estuary.
Yeah, that's why I was kind of interested to know if they're causing any damage because, I mean, ranches, yes, they cause damage. I mean, that's the nature of the animal, but I was just wondering how it was affecting the Back Bay.
Yeah, we haven't seen, done any monitoring to actually measure the negative effects that are going on right now, but, you know, in the literature and from the restoration kind of practitioners' best judgment and experience, it's been an issue for many environmental organizations trying to do habitat work or even just land managers. They've been an issue down in, like, Guadalupe, Napomo Dunes, or in different wetlands, and so that's not new, I guess, in the field, but it's more of like, okay, when do we want to take action? Who's going to take action? And trying to, you know, collaborate on that to get something done so it doesn't become a big problem.
Oh, thank you. Any other questions? One, once, twice, sold? Okay, Melanie,
mm-hmm.
I really
appreciate
it.
Thank you.
With that, next up is we'd like to open up the public comment. Any members in the audience that would like to bring up a topic that's not on the agenda, you're more than welcome to.
Chair and advisory board members, welcome. My name is Bill LaFay. One thing I noticed, I was down in Coleman Park the last couple weeks, and the beautiful life jacket station that you put down there, I've had a lot of comments. I sit on that little bench there all the time, and I think that needs to be explained a little bit more. People say, I'm not going to wear that. Is it free? How much does it cost? You know, I try to answer the question when I'm there, but maybe a little bit more information. Do you have to? Is it a law? I mean, I don't really know the answer to that either, but it's just a comment that I want to make. But thank you for bringing that down, because I think it does help. Coleman Park now is just inundated with people on a daily basis. And so that, I think, is a very needed service. The other thing I wanted to do, share tonight, and as I sat in this room for 7 years, that was the start of my civic engagement. And I want to announce tonight that I'm running for city council. I've sent out a letter to every resident. I have diligently been knocking on doors for the last 6 weeks. I've probably hit 1,000 homes to get the Morro Bay population, what their concerns are, and what I would like to accomplish. You know, I care deeply about this city. I've been here for 50 years, and my campaign platform revolves around the city's financial security, without which the community services we need and enjoy cannot be sustained. Our residents have made clear during my neighborhood walks that safety and our infrastructure are critically important to them. We're advocating reopening the Bonita Fire Station. I've had a conversation with Dan McCrane, and I hope we can accomplish that. The people in North Morro Bay, a lot of them don't even know there's a fire station there. When elected, I will advocate for sound fiscal policies, clean energy development, diversification of our local economy, increasing affordable housing units, protecting our bay and harbor, and supporting our local businesses. The residents of Morro Bay are very fortunate to have three very competent public safety departments, and I am committed to provide them with the resources necessary so they can continue to provide us with excellent service. And I'm running for city council to provide the leadership to keep Morro Bay fiscally strong. I'm going to concentrate on revenue and infrastructure. That's my main objective to run for city council, to try to improve the city that I live in, that I care about. My campaign is Bill LaFay for citycouncil.com. You can call me. My number is on the website, and I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Bill, any other public comments from the audience?
Hello. I am here today to, well, first, before I do this, I wanted to report that I'm on the offshore wind subcommittee with Mayor Wixom, and as your liaison, I thought I would update you on we recently had a meeting with Equinor, which is one of the three developers that have sites in the federal waters, and I just, because some of you are in the fishing community, I thought I would let you know what they told us. They've completed the first phase of their survey in their geophysical survey in their lease area in federal waters, and that took them 3 months. And they learned a lot from it, and they said that that it was very successful. There were no safety or environmental incidents, and that the seabed conditions are suitable for offshore wind. And they're going to analyze the data, and that will take them about 3 months. And the next step will be for them to do samples, soil samples of that area. But first, they are going to do the surveying in near waters, which is state waters. But that they're still waiting on permits for that, and they don't expect to start that until like spring of 2025. They're going to wait until after Dungeness crab season and whale migration and things like that, and then they will do both of those two things. And they are very open to speaking to public, you know, groups. So if you ever wanted to invite them to come to a HAB meeting, I'm sure that their liaison would do that, and that's all I have there. And then I wanted to let you know that there is going to be more. I don't, in case you don't know, Morro Bay's 60th anniversary was on July 17th, and it's going to be celebrated on September 5th, 6th, and 7th. And I have a pin for you all. And the way, I think the way, and maybe the, oh, and by the way, you are so lucky to have the city manager here today as your director and interim director, and I think, yeah, you're extremely lucky. But I think maybe she can help me. The fifth is that the music day?
The fifth, as I recall, is the Arts Day.
Sixth.
Art and Dahlia's. Okay, then the fifth is the Music Day.
The fifth is Thursday, mm-hmm. And that's the Thursday, music.
Yeah, Thursday, Friday. Yeah, thank you.
And then the Dahlia and Art Day, mm-hmm. on the sixth, and then Sunday the seventh.
Saturday the seventh. Yeah, is the parade.
And so anyone that's interested in participating in the parade with a float or anything, like the HAB might want to do, just needs to talk to the rec department. And I will give you all a pin.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lundrum. All right. While she's handing out pins, anybody else from the audience? With that, AGP, thank you. EDP, is there anybody with their hand raised on the call?
Chair.
Chair
Myers, I'm sorry. I guess, yeah, and thank you, Vice Mayor
Landrum's announcement regarding the 60th anniversary, and the information is posted on the city website, so you can find the detailed information on the website. And we're very excited for the festivities. And I also want to thank the planning committee for that event. They had put a lot of work to this 3-day celebration. And then I'm going to change subject to talk about the department. As Member Green pointed out, the harbor director, the former harbor
City Manager Kimball, I don't know if it's appropriate to do this during public comment, or do we want to wait for the staff report? Sorry? Okay, keep going, sorry.
Yeah, right. Thank you. I understand. I didn't see
it's a little weird with the roles, I know.
Yeah, I didn't see the staff report portion. So, but yeah, okay.
Please continue.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. We wanted to make sure that and the procedures are covered. And apologize if I'm just speaking where and this it's not a. I apologize. It's my first time at the York Harbor meeting. I continued to say that as Member Green pointed out, Harbor Director Tai Shifeng has officially retired from city as of July 19th. We wish him well in his future endeavors. And since his departure, I have been serving as the acting Harbor Director the last few weeks, and I have observed a remarkable variety of tasks and services this small harbor department handles. But as of today, I pass on the torch to Fire Chief McQueen. Fire Chief Dan McQueen will double duty to serve the role of the interim harbor director while we decide on the details of the next steps of the harbor director vacancy. At this point, we propose to recruit a full-time director with an updated job description that potentially incorporates waterfront economic development-related duties. This proposal, of course, is subject to the approval of the City Council. We have not had a chance to present the full details in the public yet, but I thought this committee would be very eager to know what's next, and therefore I share these details with you. In the meantime, the Harbor Department is in good hands. Becca and Lori, they are very dedicated employees, and they are strong leaders. Chief McQueen, with his 30 years of experience handling emergency responses, is a proven leader. He's very skilled at providing clear directions and the needed stability during changing times. With that, I'm going to have Chief McQueen say a few words.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity. I look forward to working with such a great dedicated staff and just helping keep the ship going in this interim period. You have an excellent group with Becca and Lori and the rest of the Harbor Patrol staff, and my goal is to just provide some oversight and, you know, help be a sounding board for advice as needed while the city recruits the next director. So I'm available for questions and happy to meet with you and take some information as well. I plan on working in a part-time, you know, one day a week down at the harbor, at least a few hours a day down there to try to get my arms around everything and just be a resource for them.
All right, thank you for that public comment. I'll turn it back to AGP to see if there's anybody on the Zoom call that has a hand raised.
Hi, Board Chair Myers. There are no raised hands in the queue.
Thank you for that. That will, unless there's questions, go ahead.
Yes, I'm very glad, Yvonne, and I'm very glad to see you out on the bay. It's important that you realize that the Harbor Department is not like the Fire Department or the Police Department, where you're waiting for somebody to respond so they can go out and do something or other. The Harbor Department is ongoing, on the water all the time, answering public situations constantly. And I'm very glad to see you out there on the water. Thank you.
Thank you, Member Dowdy. I'll go ahead and I'll probably pick this back up in the staff report because I have a few questions, but I don't want to do it during public comment at this point. I will go ahead and close public comment. With that, we'll move on to the consent calendar. Does anybody want to pull any of items A1, 2, or 3, which are basically the meeting agendas that we're caught up on? Thank you, Lori. I have a motion to approve the items on the consent calendar.
I'll make the motion to approve the consent calendar.
Second. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Whew, that one's done. With that, we'll move on to business item B1, which is the Harbor Director, Fire Chief, I think. Staff report. I don't know if that's going to be City Manager Kimball or...
Chair Myers, there's...
Oh, I'm looking at the wrong one. Jeez. Sorry about that. I was so excited last one was there. Okay. With that, B1 is actually the commercial fee vessel, commercial fees. I'll do a little bit of oversight just for the folks, and then I'll turn it over to Mary, who's we're working on that. A little bit of background. Late last year, the Harbor Director, Schifoni, asked us to look at usage of the harbor for commercial vessels, mainly the research vessels that were doing the sounding, see if there was any discretionary pricing we could do for their use of the harbor. We did do that, completed it in December, January timeframe. The conclusion of that was that other than fishing, there was no other harbors that were discriminating pricing to use the harbor based on what their usage was, whether it was charters or diving vessels or anything like that. You could charge by the vessel size, and that was pretty much it. And that's pretty common. So we kind of ended it there, wrote up the paper, and then the second ask was to go back and just look at all the fees that we're charging relative to all the other harbors. We started to go down that path, and you know, we are inexpensive, very, very affordable. But to try to do that, we got into a whole bunch of other issues, and now with the, some of the organizational changes, we're kind of on pause. I know, Mary, if you had further updates on that.
Yeah, I think we found some opportunities. For example, we charge linearly like the same amount per foot, whereas other harbors nearby scale exponentially with price as the size of the vessel increases. So I think we have some early findings. However, if there is someone who is still interested, I think it would make sense to circle back up with the leadership changes and kind of discuss the revised way forward now that Ted is not here.
All right, so that's any questions from anybody else on that? It did turn it, I don't know, Chris, if you had some comments here on that. Okay. Yeah, there's no opportunities to change the pricing. You know, if you look at the overall budget, it's not a, you know, if you increase it by 10 or 20%, it's not a huge pop to the overall budget, you know, because really the money is at the EMLs, not the stuff we're getting off the moorings, and it can encounter a lot of the rabbit holes, as I call them, that we saw in the EML, the leasing policies. You know, you can do market pricing, which has some challenges on how you calculate that. You know, do you have the nicest bathrooms or marine services? You know, you could probably charge more. So that's a challenge. And then, you know, get into the fishing. That's a subsidized industry. They also, although it's not reflected in their fees, they invest back into the harbor. How do you account for that? So it gets into more than just doing a static analysis on what we charge and the guys down the street charge. So there's some more quantitative, subjective topics. So if that's something, you know, we'll pursue, you know, we'll probably establish it. So,
My comment on that is
I realize, I'm hoping still, the commercial fees for the commercial fishermen are going to stay where they are because of the donation. And but now would not be the time to raise anything. A lot of harbors are actually letting the salmon fishermen off because this is the second year of no salmon season. A lot of harbors are actually saying, no, you don't owe us for salmon season, which is kind of nice. And we won't discuss the bathrooms.
Yeah, for the investigation we were doing, commercial fishing was out of scope. I think I'm especially interested in looking at, as we see kind of increased frequency of large vessels coming to Morro Bay, to make sure our fees are right-sized for the increased operational load that those large vessels place on the harbor.
And you're talking transient, right?
Yes.
I really want to thank the ad hoc committee for your work and effort here. It doesn't seem that there's an immediate deliverable of any kind, and that's not by any means the fault of the ad hoc committee who worked their butt off. Sometimes ad hoc committees get somewhat derailed by turnover or other things, and it's your hard work is appreciated.
Thank you. Any more questions on that before we open this item up to public comment? All right, is there anybody in the audience who would like to make a comment about the commercial vessel fees ad hoc committee? Nobody in the audience? AGP, is there anybody on the Zoom call that has their hand raised?
There are no raised hands in the queue.
All right, thank you. Nothing, we'll go ahead and close agenda item B1 and move on to B2, with is the mooring field. Happen to be a member of that one as well. I'll give a brief overview and maybe look to Jean and or the Harbor Patrol master supervisor for some of the other updates. Back in February, actually earlier this year, there was some of the mooring holders had sort of a near miss. Some of the boats got relatively close together. There was no elisions. Apparently collisions are two things, contact, but a nautical version of that is elisions if neither vessel is underway. Got that right, Chris?
Moored or docked.
Moored or docked. So the Morro Bay Yacht Club did have a number of vessels have elisions. So at that point, the harbor director asked us to form a ad hoc committee to work with the Morro Bay Yacht Club to get a better understanding of what's going on, what the harbor department could do. We met several times, talk about that process, you know, what was done. Most of that has been resolved, and I'm going to turn it over to Member Dowdy to kind of explain where we sort of ended up with that, shuffling some stuff around and changing scope and stuff like that.
Currently, we're halfway through the mooring inspection for the yacht club. The yacht club, with their approval, have shortened up the loop or enclosed a loop in the bottom chain on a couple or three moorings. And the rest of them, we're putting back where they were. We pick them up and using the right scope of chain. And that's where we are right now.
Didn't we reduce a couple to 3-1 to 2.5-1?
As per the yacht club agreement and their responsibility. Yes.
Okay. Member Vail, any other?
Yeah, this issue came to us as an opportunity to survey all moorings in the harbor, which is expensive. And in talking to people, we found out there were a finite number of near accidents or accidents. In between the yacht club and Gene's work, all of these situations have either been addressed or are to be addressed pretty much without exception. Also pretty much without exception is all of these incidents seem to occur with wind in opposition during a change in tide where boats may not be pointing in the same direction. And so I think the gun barrel we were looking down was hundreds of thousands of dollars. Problem is solved with sailors ingenuity, so I think it's pretty much a non-issue now. Also, for instance, of the accidents that occurred, one of them, or three of them, involved one boat. The yacht club had its largest boat getting too close to other boats, so they finally found a place to put it where it wouldn't get close to other boats. So a little bit more of a pragmatic rather than bureaucratic response seems to have worked.
Just add one more thing and then ask input from Harbor Patrol Supervisor. most of the events always happen in the stormy season. So when there's a lot of wind, big storms, tides, slack tides, all that piece of it. So the changes we may are fine now, but it's calm seas, calm wind. So the next storm comes up in the winter, December, January is when we'll see if those changes really take effect, or we might have new ones that we're not aware of. One last point is we did get a freebie survey for a very small subset of the moorings, basically right around the yacht club where we had those problems. We did it for free. It was interesting, but the information isn't what we already know. We know where the blocks of concrete are. We pull them up every 2 years and drop them back in the water. We can do GPS. The deliverable is nice. You know, if you look at it from a bird's eye view, it's, you know, points on the water, circles around them. The circles all overlap because the boats all move, you know, in unison normally. The real question becomes, you know, what can you, how big of a boat can you put on that? Is a 30-foot sailboat okay next to a 50-foot motorboat? And that's kind of unanswerable, unfortunately. You just have to put them out there and see what happens. There's real no science behind determining, at least that I could tell, you know, what boat can tie up to it. You know how much it has to weigh, how much the anchor chain is supposed to be, but you can't predict how it behaves in those very unique conditions when the slack tide, the wind's blowing in the opposite direction. And with that, Becca, you can tell me how wrong I was on that, but that's my landlubber version of the impression of the whole thing.
Okay. I just want to thank you guys for your time looking into this. It is not a new problem. We've faced it every year of my career, and I would say it is generally in the winter season, and agreed 100% with Member Vail that it is normally an opposing wind and tide situation, and boats change who's on what mooring, and this winter we will find some issues with new boats that we didn't see last winter, and it is a work in progress. I really appreciate Gene's patience with us and all the mooring holders requesting him to come back out and let's move this mooring one more time. The Harbor Patrol does go out and help to pull on the chain, but we cannot move the block with our boats in tow that way. So it takes actually having Gene come out with his equipment. We have been fortunate to not have any major damage over these years. Usually it's kind of a slow process, I would say, because it is at this time when the tide is turning, and it's just boats kind of from one direction, it looks like they have 10 feet between them, and then you look again, and all of a sudden they've kind of danced up next to each other, and they're just lightly touching each other. And then it's a little bit more, something gets hung up, and now they're kind of stuck or something like that. So it is a work in progress, and I will assure you the Harbor Patrol is definitely looking out for it on those situations. So thank you again for your time.
All right. Yeah, just in conclusion, we'll probably write up a short paper just summarizing what we've done. Now we have somebody to deliver it to, and it'll just be in the agenda item, and we'll just sign off. And if there is any future activities that we think that we ought to pursue, really it was the study piece that it was interesting to go spend $50,000 to go map it all out, but I don't think we learned anything new that we don't already know. It's kind of the takeaway that I had. With that, we will open up item B2 to public comment. If there's anybody in the audience who'd like to speak, you're welcome to.
Chuck Lostness. I'm a member of Morro Bay Yacht Club, and I'm on our mooring committee. I'm not the head of it. I just did a lot of the research. The biggest thing that we got concerned with and discovered and looking at is what we call swing circles and swing radius. And all of that gets calculated based on what depth of tide you picked to do the length of the road. If you pick like a minus 1 foot tide, which I believe is our right around our mean lower low water, versus the plus 3 foot, you've got a 12 foot difference in the swing radius, 24 in the diameter, and that really affects how close boats can get together in that slack tide wind situation. And that's usually in the dead of winter, end of December, 1st of January, where we have our lowest tides, and again in end of June, 1st of July. And I know Gene and I have talked about this right now. He uses a plus 3 foot tide to figure the length of the roads. And to be honest, the people on the committee were, I don't know how to explain it. We thought he was probably using something around low tide, and we were in a little bit disbelief, shock, I don't know, at the plus 3 foot, because we were getting ready to say, hey, Gene, we want all of these roads shortened to jibe with like a minus one or an even tide situation. And then when the plus 3 came out, we felt our hands were tied. We weren't going to go against that, except we did shorten up on 4 moorings as a test. I think that is something that needs to be explored, what level of tide that we do our length of road at, which directly impacts the swing circle and how close boats can get together. The other thing that I know we're going to do, another thing that directly impacts swing circle, is the length of the pennant from what attaches, you know, from the boat to the mooring ball. And although we haven't come to a final conclusion yet and we haven't done our final report, I believe we're going to require everybody on a Morro Bay Yacht Club mooring to have a less than 5 foot pennant. And that would include, like on my mooring, by the time I add in the shackle and the swivel and shackle, that takes up about a foot of distance or so. So my pennants, which are right now at about just under 5 and around 4.5, you know, they're a little bit long for what I think we're going to end up, and I'm going to shorten them again. But those are the two things. And I think the city, your maximum pennant lengths are 10 feet, 12 feet, and 15 feet based on boat size. And if those get shortened down, that will shorten the swing radius and put more space in between boats to keep them apart a little bit. And so that's kind of where we're at. I mean, we've done all kinds of research about elastic roads and screw-in anchors, and even to the shape of the block on the bottom makes a difference in how much it resists movement and things. But the two biggies are what depth you figure the length of the road at for a 3-to-1 scope, which is what the city requires, and we don't have a problem with that. That's an industry standard, you know. But, you know, that's, I don't know, I can talk all day if you've got specific questions about things.
I didn't ask Lori to set the timer, so you're okay for another minute or so.
Oh, I sometimes hit the button when I see it come on.
Yeah, I know. Anything else?
Biggies, I think, that can avoid boats coming in contact is what depth we figure the length of the road at that 3-to-1 scope, and shortening up pennants. You know, those are the two big variables in there that affect the swing radius and how close boats can get together.
Thank you. I will make a comment, and thank you very, very much. Okay. We do owe the Morro Bay Yacht Club and the Ad Hoc Committee a final review. Like I did say earlier, we did have opportunity to, we didn't know who we were writing the paper to, so we want to wrap that up, and I think that does give us an opportunity to discuss those very topics. I'm sure Gene has some comments along with Becca on that, so this is not the forum for that. But we definitely want to circle back with you to make sure that we address those specific topics. And if there's any others from the rest of the group, you don't need to come back up.
Our current rear commodore, John Weimer, is the head of the committee. You might address it to him. And I know when we get our report done, we'll definitely share it with everybody.
Thank you. And,
you know, I've put some input into that, and one of our club members is taking the lead in putting that all together. So,
all right, thank you very much.
Okay,
appreciate it. All right, and that should close item B2. Again, we'll have an update for the next agenda for next month. With that, we'll go ahead and move on to item C, declaration of future agenda items. I don't know if anybody has one. I know, I believe you do, Member Hansen. Go ahead.
So I have a request for a future agenda item B that we either create an ad hoc or have an agenda item where board members get to advise or suggest new harbor director job descriptions. I know that you're formatting it, you're figuring it all out. All of us come from different facets of what the harbor director would consider part of his job or her job, and I was actually on the lease policy, and we did a tenant in good standing document where it said what a master leaseholder. So anyway, I'm just saying that there's different parts that we all have either had with a successful harbor director that we'd like to be part of the job description and just put in our two cents, since you're actually going out there and trying to fill the position. And so whether that be an ad hoc group that is created or just you guys requesting advisement from the board as far as any job descriptions, or actually coming up with what the job description is that you're putting out there, and so we can look at it and give any kind of advisement for that. So in a nutshell, I would like the future agenda item to do an harbor advisement agenda item as far as job description for harbor director.
I'll agree to that.
I'm supportive of that, and would maybe even propose that as part of that same discussion that we identify what the role of Harbor Advisory Board is, because that might not always be clear.
All right, so to put it on as a future agenda item, I'm looking to you, Lori, to make sure we need that.
I would recommend those to be two different and not to combine them. The role of HAB should be a different item then.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so for us to put that on the agenda, we need a majority, right?
You need member consensus to add something to the future agenda items. You don't need a vote on it, you just need consensus.
Sean, Mary.
Is there a clarification? Is there a timeline on the hiring that makes this exercise either moot or advantageous?
Thank you. First, let me talk about the harbor and the advisory committee role. You certainly can have a discussion that about your recommended, you desired role. I just want to point out that there is a handbook for the advisory committee that the City Council adopted. So if this board decided to modify, to recommending modification to City Council, you can, after your deliberation, and you can suggest that to City Council. I just want to point out that there is a process that ultimately is the city council's decision what this board wanted to accomplish. And I also felt that, so to segue to my next point on the harbor director job description, we are going to work on the job description internally, and I need to check with legal and then HR to see to what extent I can bring this before this board for comment. It's a personnel related situation, so I certainly would like to invite, for example, the chair to be part of the selection committee once we come to that to that point. I just a bit hesitant at this point without, you know, consulting with HR and legal counsel to commit on something that on an HR related things. I don't want to subject ourselves to things that that may be an issue later.
City Manager Kimball, one thing I may suggest, the ad hoc committee can be cumbersome sometimes, and it does take a lot of calendar. I don't think you have a lot of calendar. It may be worthwhile to I assume you could solicit individual input, and we wouldn't run afoul of any charter rules if you wanted to solicit input, or we could proactively send information to the city manager or the individual citizen.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you.
Wow, that worked well.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Thank you, Chair Mayors. That's very, I appreciate your input. I think that would be a very, very good suggestion. Let us work on the core of the job description and get our legal, get our HR, and get all that box checked, and then we certainly, once it's, we can individually reach out to members. And also, if you have any suggestion at this point, sounds like all of you may have some expectations, and then you can certainly send me an email. You can say, I want to look for these kind of skill sets. Then that would be helpful for us to formulate our recruitment strategy. That would be very helpful for the recruitment strategy. Thank you.
Right. With that, we're kind of on the fence. We'd like to have input, but the advisory or ad hoc is kind of a, doesn't, you know, really take us 2 months to get anything.
So here's an idea that maybe for a future agenda item, because we don't change policy, we just talk about it and we make suggestions, and you may find somebody before we even have our next meeting, and we'd know that before we post it. But what if we make the agenda item to review the current job description and give input at the next meeting?
Well, let's tentatively say it's okay. I still need to run by legal and HR to make sure that if you just talk about general what you wanted to see, qualifications, that's perhaps okay. But I just want to be cautious. I don't have.
Okay, so making it a future agenda item doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually going to happen, just that we want to have it as a possibility to put on to...
Yeah, so when we pull the agenda together in a few weeks, we can discuss the details of what that would look like, or if it's feasible based on legal and other...
Certainly, the timing, as Chair pointed out, the timing is also a situation issue. And I would say that the job description... essentially will be approved by the city council, and at that time it's a public public setting, and all of you are welcome to submit your public comment at that time.
All right. So, yeah, we'll put it on as a future agenda item. It doesn't commit us, but we can have that discussion specifically on the job description. So, all right.
Can I ask, do we have other future agenda items?
Probably that didn't make it this time.
But those are, we've said in the past that we want to list those in the agenda. So every future agenda item that we haven't seen should be on there. Okay.
Yeah, I think for this particular one, that was an oversight on my part that we didn't include it, just because there's so much other stuff going on at this point. I don't know if you have that handy, Lori. I saw you poking over there a second.
You can look at the last one.
May. No, my printer didn't do a good job. All right, well, the future agenda items. Oh, she's got the spreadsheet. I see it. Would you be so kind? Oh, you're going to hand them to me. Why, thank you, Ms. Thomas. Let's see. First one is not crossed off from February. It was Embarcadero Business District Fund for Harbor Infrastructure. Sounds like a Sean one.
I don't need to read. I just want to see future agenda items on the next.
Sure. Page. Okay. Parking ad hoc, waterfront mess. Well, that was the other one that we. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I can't follow directions either. Yeah. So these will hopefully get published for our next agenda or our next meeting, which is the first Thursday of September. Doesn't conflict with the holiday, right? It's a short week, though. It's, what, the 5th or something? It's Thursday. Okay. All right. With that...
Could I request also, could I please suggest in a future agenda item to review the proposed changes to the SCIF program in response to mooring owners? That was one of the last things.
Yeah.
And then additionally, I was thinking if we could get an update on paid parking and if that has kind of officially, if there's been a decision reached on that and where things are.
Yeah, so the SCIF program we were going to have in June, but the June meeting got canceled and parking is still out there as well.
So I will say that the SCIF program contract, the changes will probably already be revised and in production by the time our next meeting is. So we can definitely review what we change, but it will already be approved. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, those two are fortunately on there, and they'll be part of there. And we're putting the agenda together for next time. Work with whoever's in charge and see if we can get those actually added so that we can actually have a robust discussion about it. And with that, unless there's anything else, any other comments, I think we're motion to adjourn. All approve, hit mute. Thank you, AGP. This concludes the call.